Well, the Middle East is on tenterhooks as it braces for region-wide protests against the opening later today of the US embassy in Jerusalem. The move formally recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, reversing seven decades of US foreign policy. It has angered Palestinians who claim East Jerusalem, of course, as the capital of their future state. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the move will foster peace.
I call on all countries to join the U.S. in moving their embassies to Jerusalem. Move your embassies to Jerusalem because it's the right thing to do. And move your embassies to Jerusalem because it advances peace.
Well, for Israel, today's embassy inauguration will be the second act in a series of diplomatic triumphs. Last week, Israel celebrated Donald Trump's decision to pull the US out of the Iran nuclear deal amid rising tensions between Israel and Iran and an escalating border conflict. That's led to questions about whether Donald Trump is using his regional partners like Israel to fight the big fight in the Middle East, contain Iran, limit America's involvement as well. Well, David Kilcullen is a former Australian Army officer. He was a counterterrorism strategist at the US State Department and a former counterinsurgency advisor to US General David Petraeus in Iraq. I spoke with him from Denver.
Hey, how are you?
The status of Jerusalem is one of the most contentious issues of the peace process. Israel considers the holy city its undivided capital. Palestinians see East Jerusalem as their future capital. How dangerous is this moment, though, for the region?
There are a number of things that are all happening very close together. One of them is the opening of the US embassy. The other is tomorrow, the celebration of the anniversary of Israel's founding in 1948, which the Palestinians call al-Nakba, the catastrophe. And Hamas in Gaza has promised to send, they've said, hundreds of thousands of people to try to storm the border fence in the south of Israel. So there could be a pretty major internal unrest problem. Thirdly, it's the beginning of Ramadan this week, and Islamic State have spiked their activity in a variety of places, including talking about targeting Israel. And then in addition, Israel and Iran have been exchanging missile and air raids over the past week in Syria. And when you add into the mix that Hezbollah just won the parliamentary elections in Lebanon last week, it starts to look fairly, a collection of fairly severe problems for Israel right now.
So the decision on the embassy, though, in terms of the way Arabs think about Jerusalem, particularly the way they think about Israel as well, and for many, the United States, along with that, this would seem a pretty provocative move. Is there any way in your mind that this could help the peace process, as the Trump administration would tell us?
So both the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government have said that you can't create a foundation for peace on a basis of lies. And what they're suggesting is that only when Palestinians and others recognize reality, which is that Israel has occupied and controlled Jerusalem in full since 1967, only when you recognize that can you start to move forward toward a peace deal. For their part, Palestinians would say, I think, that the Israeli policy is what they call exclusivist. In other words, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and only Israel, whereas the Palestinians have at various times spoken about how East Jerusalem would be the future capital of the Palestinian state, without expressing an opinion on Jerusalem being also the capital of Israel. So, you know, I think there's some differences, obviously, on both sides. What I think is most important about this in U.S. policy is that President Trump, again, is following through on a very clear campaign promise from 2015 and 2016 to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And he's doing that for partly domestic U.S. reasons, but also I think because, as I've written and a number of other people have written, he's moving toward a strategy of essentially outsourcing the conduct of operations in the Middle East to Israel and also to a Saudi and UAE-led Arab coalition. And so he's essentially giving Israel something they've been wanting for a very long time, to some extent in return for cooperation and support on dealing with Iran as he's trying to pull US forces out of Syria.
This is something you've written about more broadly, this sort of strategy that the United States seems to be rolling out, this idea of offshore balancing is the term. What does that look like? What does it mean? And how in practice is that shaping US policy in that region right now?
So there are three ways of thinking about what President Trump has been doing over the past year or so. One, and I'd say probably the most popular, is just to say that it's chaos and he's making it up as he goes along. I wouldn't rule that out. A second one is the idea that he's essentially being led by the nose by his regional partners, that he's being sort of dragged into potential confrontations by the Saudis and the Israelis, and that he just doesn't know enough or doesn't have a strong enough view to resist that that pull. The third possibility, which is something that a number of people have written about, and I pointed to it in my piece in the Oz on the weekend, is that he might actually be going for something a little different, which is this idea of offshore balancing, where you don't try to dominate a region yourself. Instead, you work through local coalitions to try to prevent your rival from dominating that region. It's a much less ambitious objective than what we've seen in the sort of series of neocon interventions since 2003. It does run the risk that you're going to be dragged into conflict by your allies. But the great advantage for President Trump is it allows you to do two things. One, bring the bulk of the troops home, which is something that he's always talked about wanting to do. And two, reserve the right to be tough and to strike unilaterally and to be aggressive as needed whenever it suits American interests. And because you no longer have so many troops on the ground, there's less opportunity for people to retaliate against you.
Can we just drill down, though, on the risks? Because clearly the risk of something like this is that you find yourself in a sort of proxy war type situation. And we have had Israel and Iran striking each other directly over the Syrian border region, producing what you could only describe as a potentially pretty catastrophic situation.
Yeah, I mean, there are two real big risks with this kind of approach. One is the risk of proxy war, which I think is not really a risk at this point, it's a reality. You know, Israel and Saudi Arabia are both in separate fights with Iran in Yemen and in Syria. And of course, the Iranians are sponsoring groups like Hamas and Hezbollah that are opposed to Israel and are also sponsoring the Houthis in Yemen who are fighting Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So there's already a proxy war going on that has the potential to draw people in. The other big risk is that you're sort of outsourcing foreign policy to local partners whose interests are not the same as yours. And a twist on that in the case of Israel is that the Israelis have been increasingly turning to Moscow for support and brokering discussions about how to approach Iran. It's a bit of a stretch to suggest that President Trump has thought through all of that and decided on balance that it's still a good idea. I think what we've seen from him over the past 18 months or so is a sort of trial and error approach where he's sort of attempting to see how far he can get with this approach. But we've also seen from him a really strong and unusual degree of interest in following through on campaign promises. And I think that's the basic driver here.
We've been reporting overnight on a series of attacks in the Indonesian city of Surabaya. The country's intelligence agency says the attacks were carried out by a group inspired by Islamic State, Jemaah Ansarut Daulah, or JAD. Clearly, we have always been told that military defeat on the ground against ISIS in Iraq and Syria would lead to a spike in attacks elsewhere in the world. Obviously, Indonesia has had a very significant number of fighters return from Syria and Iraq. In your view, are we likely to see more of this sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, this is the beginning of Ramadan this week, and Islamic State have said that they want a Ramadan offensive. And if we look at the previous years when they've done that, the way that it has played out has been a series of individual but also group attacks in Europe, Africa, Middle East, and Southeast Asia. The Indonesian attack overnight is unusual in that it was basically an entire family who carried out a suicide attack. I don't think we've seen that before in Indonesia or indeed anywhere else. So that's a new element that analysts are looking at pretty closely now. But as you mentioned, you know, hundreds of Indonesians traveled to Syria and elsewhere to fight with Islamic State. Many of them have returned. I would not place Indonesia at the top of my list in terms of the more dangerous locations for Islamic State to strike during Ramadan, but it's certainly on the spectrum.
David Kilcullen there speaking to me earlier from Denver.